All right. Governance Committee will come to order. First, you have in front of you the agenda for our meeting today. Is there a motion to approve the agenda?
Some move.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the agenda is approved. You also have in front of you the minutes from our December 19th meeting. Any comments, corrections, or is there a motion to approve the minutes as submitted?
Some move.
All right, it's been moved. There's a second from my vice chair. Okay, Tom. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay. Next item is action item, acceptance of the 2013 board evaluation. Everybody has that evaluation in your packet. Are there any comments on that? All right, it's been moved. There's a second. All right, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the 2013 board self-evaluation as submitted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay. Next item is an information item. It'll be a review of resolutions and governance documents. Where's General, are you here representing Catherine?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I understand that Catherine has an emergency, and I worked with her on this, so I can fill in.
Okay. All right. Well, you're on. First item is resolutions review update.
Yes. Just to go over a little bit of history first, we have a resolution database being hosted by American Legal Publishing, which organizes all the resolutions by subject matter. And I think my filling in duties have just about come to an end.
You did a hell of a job.
I'll finish
I was impressed.
This thought briefly. The online database provides a way to browse resolutions topically as well as several search features. It provides a summary of the resolutions within each topic. It denotes when a resolution has been explicitly superseded by a subsequent resolution. That resolution is watermarked superseded. And at the bottom, there's a link to the current resolution. The current resolution also provides a link back to the superseded if you wish to review that. Plus, there are tables that that one can use to work their way forward and backward among superseded and current resolutions. So for our purposes today, the committee requested that we basically break down the resolutions as they're currently organized by committees so that they could then be reviewed by the committees for any policy issues. What we've handed out provides that breakdown by committee.
Okay.
Let me clarify that. I think there was interest in understanding what the level of effort would be if the board wants to undertake such a review, and so to inform you so you can decide whether it was the level of importance in moving in that direction.
To understand just exactly what the level of effort would look like for that kind of a review. So, as you can see, it's it would be a relatively intensive effort, and it could certainly be done. Thank you. But it would take some time and would need to be managed, and would just like your input on if that's the direction you'd like to go, and how would you like to have that committee work staffed. And
okay, well, I think what we're looking at, what she's referencing is we've broken it down according to committee and for audits and investigations, 150 resolutions, customer service and operations. Ms. Hudgens, you've got 2,200. Finance and administration, 2,500. Governance, 400. Planning program, 200. Safety and security, 200. What's the level of effort that you think, if we wanted to pursue all that, what would it take in your estimate?
Well, I think that these resolutions that have not been expressly superseded, as Phil described before, will require a review of the intent or purpose of the resolution. These are the ones that are not as obvious. The ones that are that were obvious were have been picked up in the resolution database work that's already been completed. So this would be, you know, a review by the committee or members with knowledge of what the current resolution database, you know, what we currently have in active resolutions, to determine after reviewing the language whether in substance or effect what we have in another resolution has superseded or replaced in pertinent part these what we believe to be the old resolutions.
All right.
Clarification. This array of some 5,000, those are only ones that have not been superseded?
That includes all the resolutions. So it does include some that have been explicitly superseded. That's a fairly small subset of all that. And if I may, when staff undertook an effort just to double-check the categorization that American Legal had performed, just in terms of subject matter, so that was a double-check on subject matter only, spent an order of, I would say, 300 to 400 man hours to do that.
And again, in terms of this universe of resolutions, are these uniquely assigned committees, or any of them double counted?
Some are double counted because
it
covers two subject matters, so when broken up by subject, it appeared in two different places.
Okay. Well, I guess the reality is, though, this process needs to be done because we need to make sure that whatever we have in place is, in fact, operative and not inconsistent and what have you. And I guess the question is, do we want to do it sooner or later?
Quickly or slowly.
Well, that's true. What would be, I mean, just given the resources that would be involved and the time involved, do you have a suggested approach we should take on this? Because we can't just say, well, okay, we're not going to do it. It's just too much work. That's just not a viable option. Yes.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity and burden of having done this work before in my real life job. And I'm not volunteering. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We're just sharing a few lessons because we had to address the same issue. I think this is important work that we're doing. So I want to say on the record, it's very important, and I'm pleased that the board and management has moved ahead with this. I think it's important that we review the old, quote, outdated resolutions because they do create problems for you sometimes that you don't expect. And I think we're doing work that's going to sustain the authority over time. So it's important work we do while we're here. One approach that we used was to determine the priority areas. And so you do the priority areas first. It's also important to remember this really is a journey. It took us 3 years, and we're at the end of that process. But I think if we identify the areas that we think are the highest priority, and we just drill through it, and I think it's important that we allocate the resources, because this is one of those circumstances where it's not urgent, but it's important. And many times, urgent takes over important.
I agree. Okay, but with that in mind, can you come back to us with a proposed approach that would look at what the priorities ought to be and what the resources might be needed and what might be a projected time frame for doing this, even if it does take 3 years?
Sure, we can do that. I mean, and we were talking among ourselves, we could either approach this by subject area, for example, as is broken out here, or we could just go back and say we're going to do all the ones from do the oldest in time first. Let's go through the 1960s because the chances are that those are probably going to be no longer pertinent. But we'll give the approach some thought and staffing and a timeline and come back to you with our recommendations.
Well, do any of the committee members have any suggestions? I mean, when you did it, did you do it sequentially or was it subject matter? Okay. Although I must admit the time sequentially seems to could have some idea. Well, I'll tell you, why don't you just take a look and just you give us a recommendation of what you think would be the most efficient way for us to do it. Mr. Chairman?
It's also, I agree that this should be a intermediate term, long-term objective that we're
I agree. And that sounds like a very solid plan. General Counsel, are you comfortable with coming back to us with something along those lines?
Yes.
Okay. All righty.
The next item we wanted to discuss, just report back on our review of the governance documents. And my thought would probably take most of the time this morning is to review was the review of the I want to talk in some detail about the suggested changes to the ethics codes or areas where I think we need to have some discussion about the ethics code. But I should tell you that I did a broad review of the board bylaws and procedures and the code of ethics. And, of course, I had the benefit of having, you know, really fresh eyes at this, in addition to being the first ethics officer of WMATA and having now gone through some review in that capacity. So I have some changes to suggest primarily to the code of ethics and also to the procedures that relate to the ethics process. And then finally, a couple of matters I wanted to bring to your attention regarding clarifications to the bylaws. So both my review and my experience as in doing some work as the ethics officer has led me to conclude that we could benefit from clarifying the definition and approach to how we deal with apparent conflicts of interest arising under the Code of Ethics Article 3, and how those potential conflicts of interest would be disclosed, and really the process associated with apparent conflicts And also conflicts that are reported to us that come back to WMATA through the joint development process. As you will recall, in the joint development policy, in a change that was made in July of last year, we now require potential joint development partners to disclose back to WMATA any interests that that developer is aware of having with a board member or staff members. And we require them to submit not only the names of their individual officers and principals, but also their affiliated and subsidiary companies, and then to report what they know to be interest, financial or otherwise, that they might have either, again, with WMATA staff or with the board members. But we feel like we would benefit from having a procedure really tied back to when those disclosures come in from the joint development partners or potential partners, how WMATA processes those when they come into the secretary's office. So we have outlined a process that would incorporate how that would work, and it follows what we have done informally now within the ethics officer review, but would have the third party disclosure would come into the secretary's office, would be given to the ethics officer. The ethics officer will then make that information available to the board member or staff member and give the board member or staff member the opportunity to make their disclosure, which then becomes part of the secretary's file on a permanent basis. So it would be in addition to the annual disclosure that board members are already making, there would be this disclosure that would be updated when information is available, whether brought to the attention by a third party or the board member being aware that this matter is coming for the board for action. So we wanted to just propose some language that would identify a procedure for it so that those steps are very, very clear about how it works through the WMATA process. And then in the next section, number three, we wanted to suggest methods for how these prohibited conflicts could be cured. Right now, our code talks about the potential only of recusal, but in our examination of code of ethics from other transit properties and other local boards, in particular the Washington Area Sanitation Association, MWA, and also the LA's MTA Transit Board, we think that it would be beneficial to have a range of options for curing a potential conflict, so that in addition to recusal, board members could cure a conflict by divesting funds received. So, for example, if a board member who is an elected official happened to receive a political contribution, a campaign contribution, that from a joint development party or potential party, and became aware of that contribution had been made, we suggest that the divestiture or sale of the asset or other interest in that circumstance prior to the board member taking action would be appropriate. It is consistent not only with the law of the jurisdictional partners, but it's really a consistent approach that's quite well established in federal practice as well. That would allow the board member to cure the conflict, but then participate in the action once the funds had been returned and the asset divested. We also believe that we could strengthen the language that does exist in the current policy about a declaration, how a board member should. Right now it contemplates that if an apparent conflict, the board member receives, has an interest in that could give rise to an appearance of a conflict of interest, but that the board member believes he or she could still participate objectively. There is a contemplated in our current code a way for the board member to make a declaration of that fact, but it has the board member just doing that in writing on a form that is filed with the secretary's office. And we believe that it would strengthen the process for the declaration to continue to make the make the statement in the manner already contemplated, but that we would have the chair read the declaration into the record in a public setting, both either before the board committee or before
either before the board meeting or before a committee meeting prior to any action being taken, so that the declaration is on the public record prior to action. We wanted to suggest clarifications to the recusal language to clarify that that unless otherwise directed, a recused member may remain present for the public portion of the consideration of the matter, provided that the member doesn't remain at the table or the dais, that they participate as a member of the public would, but they don't have to leave the room. And we wanted to suggest clarifying that that nothing would prohibit a board member from participating if the board member is legally required in order for the decision to be made. So this is really attempting to get at the jurisdictional veto issue to make sure that we have the opportunity for our board members to participate, notwithstanding the conflict in that circumstance. Of course, after full disclosure and discussion in the public setting of the prior to action. The next section deals with the method for obtaining and preparing ethics opinions. And just wanted to clarify that right now the Code of Ethics contemplates that a board member may request an opinion of the ethics officer. We wanted to clarify that, in addition to board members requesting an opinion, the chair, the first vice chair, or the ethics committee could request an opinion, and would clarify that requests for written opinions would include a written disclosure of the material facts. And the reason for requiring that it be in writing is just to make sure that the record is clear what the factual assumptions were that were the predicate for the opinion that was rendered.
Can I ask a question here? So in other words, you're contemplating that if the chair or the vice chair become aware of a situation that they think might be a problem, even though that individual member did not raise it, they could request the opinion, correct?
Correct. Yeah, right now the rules just contemplate that it's a board member that will come forward about their own circumstance. Okay. And this would say if a member of the ethics committee or the board chair or vice chair became aware of it, let's just say through a circumstance of a joint developer disclosure, or any other way in which information came forward, that it would be clear that that it would be appropriate for the ethics officer opinion to be requested. Wanted to clarify that the ethics officer could conduct any investigation of facts as necessary to render prior to rendering an opinion, and that if the investigation revealed conduct that would give rise to a criminal investigation, that the ethics officer at that point would step out of the process and simply refer that matter on to the appropriate prosecutor and then so advise the board. The next section deals with formation of the ethics committee. And we thought it was useful to actually formally define the ethics committee and suggest that the ethics committee would be formed by the executive committee, that in other words, the executive committee would function as the ethics committee on ethics matters, with the clarification that in the circumstance where a member of the executive committee was the member who had the conflict that was being discussed, that the board chair would replace that member of the executive committee with another member from the board in a manner that would comprise appropriate representation by each signatory and a federal member to comprise that particular ethics committee for consideration of that matter in circumstances where a member of the standing executive committee had the conflict that was being discussed. We also wanted to clarify that when the ethics committee is meeting that, or in other words, when the executive committee is meeting as an ethics committee, that it is limited, that other board members would not be invited to participate, such as is the case now on executive committee participation. We wanted to clarify the importance in offering the affected board member the opportunity to present information, either written or orally, and with or without the assistance of counsel or another representative, if that board member wanted to be heard. I think it's important that the opportunity for process, due process of the matter, be fully considered by the Ethics Committee, and wanted to clarify that specifically in the procedure. Wanted to clarify that there are various stages at which the potential ethical issue could be resolved. I mean, perhaps the majority of instances, the issue will be resolved by the ethics officer in working in direct consultation with the board member. In other circumstances, if that isn't resolved at that level, the ethics officer would advise the board chair of the need to call a meeting of the ethics committee, and the ethics committee would then consider the matter with participation by the affected board member. If it's not resolved at that level, then the matter would be brought forward to the full board for consideration at a subsequent board meeting following normal board process. We wanted to clarify that the board would have available to it, or the ethics committee would have available to it, a range of appropriate sanctions, which could include not only reprimand and censure, but also involuntary recusal. And so the issue here is that if there is a disagreement between the board member and the ethics officer and or ethics committee about whether recusal is necessary or appropriate in a particular circumstance, that the board could make a determination, and that determination could include involuntary recusal of the board member on the particular issue. And to clarify that, the board's determination is a public record and would be put on the record and provided to the affected board member's appointing authority. The appearance of conflict issue. I'm sorry.
In the heading of that section, refers to dissolution of the ethics committee.
Oh, I'm sorry. That should have been stricken. There was an earlier iteration, but that is no longer relevant. Thank you.
It's dissolved.
It's dissolved. Yes. We felt like it was important to have a further discussion and consider broader language on what exactly constitutes an appearance of a conflict of interest. And we'd like to bring back for consideration at the next board meeting, or the next governance committee meeting, language. We've put forward there language from both the MWA's definition of an appearance of conflict and the language from the LA MTA about the appearance of a conflict. But in the WMATA ethics code, the language is not very clear about appearance issues. And so we think that that is an area that could be strengthened to define that more carefully. And so we'd propose bringing back alternatives for the committee's consideration on what other properties do, transit properties, and what other local and jurisdictional authorities do on that issue for consideration. I'd like to move into areas beyond the ethics code. So are there other questions about the recommendations we're making that you'd like?
Yes, ma'am.
In the instance when the matter comes to the board, would you anticipate it comes to the board with a recommendation from the ethics officer or from the committee? So the issue is framed when it gets to the board.
Yes.
Versus an initial review like what would have occurred in the committee level. So how do we get the actions occurring in the committee before the board? I'm really raising the question about how it's framed.
Yes. It's contemplated in Section 6G that if the matter is not resolved during the Ethics Committee proceedings, that the Ethics Committee, that's the point at which an opinion of the ethics officer could be requested by the Ethics Committee, and that would be transmitted together with a summary of the proceedings
to the full board, so they would have the benefit of the history of the proceeding to that point.
But it's only on the request.
What is only on the request?
That the evidence officer opinion would only be triggered by the request.
Well, it's possible that, the ethics officer could have given a prior opinion to the board member. If that were the case, that opinion would have gone forward to the ethics committee at the time it was unresolved between the ethics officer and the board member. That opinion would have gone for would go forward to the ethics committee for its consideration. It may so it's possible also that there was never a prior opinion given, at which point the ethics committee could request an opinion, and the ethics officer could give the opinion at that point. So it's possible it could have come about in one of two ways at that point in time, at least as is suggested here. We could, of course, consider a range of other alternatives, but that's the way we've set it forth here.
Okay. You have a follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, this is, you know, just my view. I mean, we give great weight to our ethics officer. And if a matter is coming to the board, it would seem to me the board would have the benefit of the ethics officer's opinion when it when it's framed and comes to the board.
So are you more comfortable that prior to it going to the board, the ethics committee would request an opinion, so that that is part of the package?
Okay. Did you cap it?
I was hearing Ms. Hampshire Collins speak. I agree. I think it gives one. I think it solidifies the work of the committee, and then that work along with the opinion guides the discussion for the board in a much more way. That helps. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, if you could incorporate that into what you present, that would be great. Any other questions? Mark?
Could you take another look at the quorum for the ethics committee, particularly how it would affect federal members?
Yes, I noticed that actually when I was repeating it, and that I think is an error, but we will make sure that that is clear. It was the intention.
So you're saying it should be four members, right?
Probably.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
So I'll move on now to the next section of the memo, which
Can I interrupt one quick second? How are we doing on time? Should we wrap this up pretty quickly? Or?
Well, we should.
Okay.
The next section was on the general counsel relationship, and you had requested clarification about the dotted line reporting relationship and how to ensure that there was open and regular communication and reporting. And so what this is proposing is that we make it clear that in 1A that there's a dotted line reporting relationship, but notwithstanding the formal reporting relationship, a statement that the board seeks regular and open communication with the general counsel. We're suggesting that they make it clear that the general counsel may request a meeting with the board or an appropriate committee whenever there is an issue that requires immediate attention. Making it clear that the board will schedule in an executive session on a quarterly basis the general counsel to come and report to the committee on matters as may be appropriate, including status of litigation and any upcoming legal issues or other matters appropriate for executive session, and making it clear that the board and any of its committees may at any time request a meeting with the general counsel. So just clarifying that it's intended to be open and transparent and regular, and that that there will be built-in quarterly meetings, but that at any time either party can request a meeting when there's an issue that is appropriate for further consideration.
Very good. All right, any questions on that? I think that pretty much captured what we agreed to.
Okay. And then the final issue we wanted to raise was there was a
recent discussions with a financial management oversight reviewer that was here for other reasons that had made some suggestions that the bylaws could be strengthened regarding the membership of the Audit and Investigations Committee. And so I wanted to incorporate the recommendations of that into our discussion today, since we were having this discussion today. And it's suggesting that there be specific requirement that a member of the audit committee have expertise in financial matters, that the audit committee be required to meet one of the members. That's the recommendation, correct, that a member, and that there be a requirement that the audit committee, I think they be hold more than one public session per year, and the specific recommendation was at least two sessions per year should be public. That was the auditor's view of the best practices. That there be in the bylaws a requirement that the audit committee meet at least twice a year with the external audit, before and after the audit, and that the audit committee meet at least twice per year with the inspector general. I just wanted to bring those forward because they were just delivered orally and not formally yet, but I just, because those were concerns or issues that were identified as that would strengthen WMATA's bylaws as it relates to the audit committee, I thought it was important that you have that information for your consideration.
Okay. Well, are people comfortable us having that incorporated into what you present to us? I think we should, unless it's an objection. So what you come back to us with the final documents, or at least documents for review, should include that.
Okay.
Changes to bylaws. Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? If not, I'm going to thank you for your review of this. This is very, very helpful, and we look forward to it. What sort of time frame are we looking at as far as getting something back on the codification as well as these documents? When's a reasonable time?
Well, we'll certainly be prepared at the next governance meeting in February. We will circulate in advance redline versions of the pertinent documents incorporating the changes as revised today.
Okay.
And we'll also give you a recommendation at that point on codifying the resolution project.
Okay, so we're looking at February 13th.
We'll do both.
Okay, all right. Any other questions? Anything else to come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.